Hello and welcome to Hacks and Flacks with me, Petri Hoskin. Hacks and Flacks is the only series where you'll get the inside scoop on how journalist hacks and the flacks of government and business work behind the scenes to decide which stories you'll be reading with your morning coffee, and perhaps more importantly, how they keep certain headlines off the front pages. What happens if a public figure is a subject of a salacious story? When does a scandal make or break a career? And how do you really know what is or isn't fake news? All these subjects and a whole lot more will be explored by me and a regular panel of hacks and flacks, ready to spill the beans and tell us how the sausages get made. Flacks like former government advisers Giles Kenningham.
Hello.
And Andrew McDougall.
Hello.
Plus hacks like Mick Booker.
Hello.
So now all the gang's here, let's delve into the world of hacks and flacks.
She's reading through it. The temperature drops when it gets to that bit. And she sends her says, "Hey, so can you tell me who butchered my speech?"
Hello and welcome to another Hacks and Flacks. Today's show will be an education, because in my hand I have a piece of paper with the names of my panel on it for this week. And I'll never surrender until I've said hello to Andrew McDougall.
Bonjour.
And this lady isn't for turning in the presence of former journalist and political speechwriter Asa Bennett.
Hello. Great to be here.
When I first read that, "this lady isn't for turning," I thought Asa was a lady.
So I identify differently for this episode.
I'm glad you've dressed very nicely. Asa, you have a background in political journalism, but then you became a speechwriter for Liz Truss. How did
Why are you laughing?
One of the questions later on is, you know, about her acceptance and resignation speech, and I was thinking you could have just written one speech for that.
Harsh. Oh, spoiling the punchline. let's work our way up first.
How did you make the leap from journalism to working for Liz Truss?
I think it was the opportunity then came when her team reached out to me while I was at the Telegraph. I'd been writing for over 5 years about Brexit, current affairs and all sorts, and veering into international trade. And they clearly recognised that I was able to put it bluntly, in all compliments to former colleagues, write better than many officials could. Because they were saying that, you know, Liz wasn't much impressed by the sort of copy she was getting from them, and so wanted to bring in someone who could, to put it crudely, make the detail more retail. Given you had always have these nuts and bolts of trade deals to try and make it that sort of thing, you know, this means you get cheap cars, cheap, you know, wine, we can sell this, that and the other. This means money, jobs, make it more sort of gripping.
So and dumb it down.
But liven it up. Liven it up, I prefer to say. Because, like, I think it's, you have to remember when, so to make trade sexy in another manner, because if, let me put it to you this way, in a comms way, if something happens, if you put out a press release and no one reads it, it's not in the Sun, did it matter? Did it really change anything? Whereas if it's in the Daily Mail, if you've got an op-ed there, page 5, saying this is why you should get excited by, you know, this fantastic, you know, new thing we've done with America or whatever, like, then you really people are buying into it, you're changing minds, you're really hammering home the good that the government's doing in that department.
And I'd say, just pick up on that, it's universal amongst bureaucracies that they speak in their own language. I think everybody knows that, but they do forget what it means to people. They talk about the what happened and under what authority and under what program and under what program responsibility, all the stuff that they care about because it impresses their colleagues, but they too often forget what it means. And I can think of an example for the Prime Minister I worked for. We were going to a province to announce the twinning of a road, highway. And you think, okay, that's boring.
Yeah.
But, and then, you know, the bureaucrats gave us a speech that said basically essentially that. You know, we're investing $35 million to twin 2.85 kilometers of this road between these two towns. And our job on the political side is to go, look, this will mean you get home to your family and kids faster. You know, you'll be able to get to the cottage more quickly.
Mm.
You make it about how it will make a difference in their life, not about the actual what it is. It is the what it means. And it's endemic. It's horrible. And more people need to learn from the political side of communications about how you do the motive, why am I doing this? And then the why, what it means to you in practical terms.
Do you think that's why so many journalists do end up going into the political sort of speech writing sphere?
Well, I think it's because, you know, we know that previously I was having to help assess pitches for the Telegraph, work out what was worth printing, to put it bluntly. And so you know how to distill, have that discipline of boiling a message down to 800 words, you know, working out that, you know, amid all the gumph you'll get from policy and lawyers saying, did you know in this trade deal with Canada, we've agreed a chapter on women's economic empowerment? And you go, great, what does that mean in practice? And they're like, well, it means we just have talks and just discuss women and whether they should be empowered. And you're like, okay.
Thank you, Justin Trudeau, for making that a cornerstone of your trade policy.
And the thing is, and actually one last nugget
on that. That's what we need, by the way. That's really what we need.
And so you have to get
talking about.
You have to break open the talking shop. So you have to sort of, and like when moving with her to the Foreign Office, and actually before we get there, actually, one thing I'll say is a lot, as soon, and I'm sure many listeners will think, as soon as they hear Liz Truss and speech writing, they'll think, did I write the cheese speech, for example? You know, that
or
was
the pig speech.
Well, the Port Market's cheese and all that, you know, that was fair years before my time. But I think it illustrated a sense of communication there of, you know, it's what people understand about, you know, exporting at your food and drink, effectively. It's that sort of real primary colour stuff of people understand business and international business like that. You know, she got it in that sense. Whereas often you could have too much of an ivory tower approach in government where, you know, as long as you're all satisfied, then it doesn't really matter if people are really buying into it. You sort of forget to communicate. So in the Foreign Office, for example, you know, as diplomats can often talk to diplomats too much, and then you can often have, you know, foreign ministers endlessly flying around the world, shaking hands, projecting good vibes, saying, God, we really got on well, and the canapes were amazing. But then, okay, what does it mean? You know, what are you doing for jobs back at home? What are you doing for investment? What are you doing for make the world a safer and better place? That's kind of what we really have to kind of grip when you're going into there. And speeches are part and parcel of that, to help, you know, at press conferences say what on earth you're doing there, to help sort of distill them into, you know, op-eds about back home, to write the messages that people really you need to hear.
Well, just a thing, like, do you know what a reduction in tariffs, do you know what that means?
Yeah.
Do you know what cheaper stuff means?
Oh,
it means
like
you'll spend less when you go to buy this. And that's it. And the bureaucrats or the diplomats that talk to the diplomats, they deal all day in tariffs because that's what they have to negotiate. Tariff rates. What does that mean for someone who needs to buy things? Make them understand
the
bit.
The problem with speech writing, it must be like script writing. You write a script, you give it to a bad actor, and it's a bad script, right?
Mm.
So you write a speech, and you give it to somebody who notoriously, Liz Truss, was not known for being a good speech giver, and it's a bad speech.
I think it's that, ultimately, the principal is the chief speech writer. I'm merely trying to write what she would if she had all the time in the world to bash out stuff on the laptop and keyboard. So I think what you have to appreciate for that, just like with a good script, you know, it's what comes naturally to you. So
speech giving was not natural to Liz Truss. I mean, anyone could see
she
that.
Is not Obama, and she knows that. And so if they've tried to write a sort of Kennedy-esque, you know, sort of, we choose to go to the moon because of this, we choose it not because it's easy, but because it's hard, you know, and all that sort of epic, soaring rhetoric, that would have been clunky and rung false from her. When ultimately, you have to sort of get in their heads, understand, you know, how they talk, and, you know, for her, the to get your eye in, you have to remember, you know, she used to be a think tanker. She's very much a maths graduate, and so very much would be all about sort of. It's a logical flow that has to be clear, you know, about why we're doing this. We're doing this because of this. I'm signing this deal, and this means that. It's very sort of clear arguments. So it's not, I mean, often when I'd write drafts, I might get a bit carried away with florid purple prose and then be told to sort of prune it back a bit, make it more so, where's the evidence for this? You know, there's too much fluff. And so that was only the tension you'd have. And I'm sure you have endless amounts of time with all sorts of prime ministers, ministers alike. You know, how you make sure that it's not just, well, I'm thinking, for example, of other speakers who people generally say are much, you know, better speakers, like Boris Johnson. He's entertaining, freewheeling, freestyling and all. But if you actually read the speeches and watch a full Boris Johnson speech, they're long. They're rambling. They sort of lose focus. You sort of forget why you're there.
Yes, but people, I would suspect, would prefer to watch a Boris Johnson speech than a
Completely.
Liz Truss speech.
For pure entertainment, yes.
Yes.
But that's
the problem you have, isn't it? Is that you could write the most beautiful speech in the world, but if it's delivered by Liz Truss, it's not going to come out the way perhaps you wrote it.
Well,
that's not... Let me step in here. I don't think that's very fair. You know, if you go back to the script analogy...
She was a terrible public
speaker. Okay, but look,
speaker.
Some people think
well
that Clint Eastwood is a horrible actor. And if you were to give Clint Eastwood that soaring rhetoric, nobody would buy it from him. But if you give him a short, terse, kind of menacing thing, it can become a very effective piece of communication in movie going.
And do you think Liz Truss
and
did
that's,
that?
But that's what you have to do. And it's not just a question of the words on the page and how do you write them. It's what's the audience? What's the moment? You know, the prime minister I work for, Stephen Harper, he didn't tend towards the lofty rhetoric, but he would go there if the occasion merited it. So if we're making that local highway announcement, you make it as boring as you can, and you drop one or two very punchy lines, because you'll know every journalist in the back of the room will perk up and go, oh, that sounded different. Let me write that down. And that's a very deliberate tactic. But when we were, for example, in one speech always stands out, was in Normandy, and then later on the trip we went to the Netherlands to commemorate the war dead 65 years on from D-Day. And you could be very emotional there. You could go for it. You could stretch yourself. And you knew that he would go there and really take the time to wind that up because it mattered to him.
Mm.
And that's the other thing I think he's saying, is that you also have to, you have your canvas, which is the politician. And you have to know what they like on their canvas. And you have to know when you can stretch them. And it might not just be because I feel like stretching you in this. It has to be this occasion merits me stretching you. And you'll know that they'll get that this is a moment that they have to go out there and try to meet in that way, in a way that a conference speech is manifestly different from like an election stump speech and is different from a standard number 10 announcement, which is standard from a coronavirus briefing. So you really do. It is about matching the politician to the words, to the moment. And sometimes the politicians you think are less effective on the podium are actually more effective if the situation demands it. If it's a very serious situation, you'd probably rather listen to Liz Truss than Boris Johnson because of her manner of speaking and her style of working logically, as Aza said, through an argument. So it's not just, you were crap. And like even, you know, the cheese speech, if you were to read that, I bet you would read a lot more effectively. But when you see it delivered, and that's the same as acting.
And that,
yeah,
but that's what I'm talking about, is that you can write the best speech, but if it's...
Like everybody can tank.
The only sort of defense point I'd say in defense of the cheese speech of all things, this is a bold ask, but is that if you're going to a conference where effectively you are just doing tub-thumping speeches about your brief, in which you say, God, isn't it great to be defense secretary, and we are the toughest, strongest nation on earth, and want those clap lines. And if you're in this case, for her case, you are the environment secretary. You know, what on earth do you talk about except how great food is? You know, admittedly, you know, there's many other things. You get a misty eye, clearly, that sort of Jerusalem starts playing. It's a patriotic, it's the sort of rally-ish sort of atmosphere. It lends itself to that sort of speaking. Granted, the delivery, you know, different matter entirely. So I think all these things you have to take into account.
Did you ever try and help her with delivery? Did you ever try and...
Delivery. I think it was often in the rehearsals. So and also lent itself to trying not to, just like with scripts, making sure you could have sentences you could take it, you know, very cleanly, not have to sort of lose momentum, have to stop for breath halfway through. I might accidentally have put some too many sub clauses into these things, and you have to realize then these are very much delivered, you know, meant to be done. You know, orally, they're not meant to be sort of op-eds that you just read, nice essays that just go on and on, and so. Having that syntax, knowing when to shorten the sentences, go more staccato and build up that sense of, you know, urgency if it's breathless, you know, the Blair-like style verbalist sentences where you just sort of you're saying, you know, broken homes and, you know, broken society. And then like, it's knowing when to vary that up. That's always key.
How much input did she have? I mean, talk me through how you would write a script. Did you just get a, you know, pile of briefing notes and numbers and you had to turn that into something?
It's sort of like that. I think I'd have an idea of the commission of, okay, there's a moment she's going to speak at, let's say, the signing of this, or an occasion when she's in Kyiv and she's going to speak alongside the foreign minister. You know, these are the things on her mind. I might have an initial chat with her where she's just saying, okay, I want to hit these points, blah, 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 you just string it all together. And then we review it. And then at that point, it's clear whether she needs something brought out more to make it tougher or, you know, softer. Officials may start looking at it in parallel and start fretting about things. If I'm about to cause a diplomatic incident or not, you know, we start to mediate and deal with the politics around it. And eventually a compromise is reached in which, you know, she could feel it's strong enough to get their messages, you know, clear while not fudged enough by other people sort of messing with the text. Certainly... Let's put it this way. I remember many times there'd be tensions in that sort of sausage machine process of putting it together. So, for example, I remember in the Trade Department when she was going to do a speech on, you know, the importance of free trade and how there basically, a lot of colleagues came in from the communications section with all sorts of ideas now to make it really gripping. And they were like, and I remember one of them, a senior fellow still there, saying, you know, Secretary of State.
Name names, please.
Not yet,
you can name names.
Not yet. I'm sort of lock and key. And it's a Secretary of State, you know, so it's great, you know, 95% of the speech is about, you know, knocking down barriers and making it cheaper to buy your New Zealand beef or lamb and your wine from Australia and all the rest of it. Should we not acknowledge the tensions of, you know, free trade? What it means for producers at home, farmers, and everything else. Should we not acknowledge the on-balance point, the on the one hand, on the other? She sort of paused and looked around the room and said, could someone tell me who let this pinko in, please? So she was very... Obviously, he was duly chastened.
Trez on brand.
For the rest of the meeting. But the point is that, like, she knew...
No, but seriously, that was a dumb thing to say.
And so, like, she ultimately was a very... She was the chief editor, the chief speech giver. Yeah. Nothing... You know, given speeches, the op-eds, you could just look at them and go, God, I write very well. Tick, you know. But then speeches that you are having to stand up at the podium, the lectern, deliver it with a full oomph that you can muster... Of course she's going to be fussy and keen on that. And so I remember, you know, a way after that, so when she was about to be Prime Minister and obviously I was working up the draft she'd give outside number 10. And if you go back through previous speeches, previous Prime Ministers always say a variation as their first line of, I've just been to Buckingham Palace and, you know, accepted... Well, Her Majesty's, invitation to form a government, offer to form a government. Looking back to that, I'd phrased it as, just accepted Her Majesty's offer to form a government. And she'd said, you know, after reflecting on it, you know, actually, I prefer to say invitation because offer makes it sound like the Queen's an estate agent. taking a point.
So that's what killed her.
Oh, sorry.
Whoa. Sorry, Your Majesty.
Too soon.
Sorry.
Too soon.
I would always shit up our officials when they would start monkeying around with a speech too much. And it was going back and forth. And you do realize the Prime Minister will be at the podium and will say what he wants to say about this.
Yes.
So your objection is noted, but if I change it back, it's because what I want, okay?
And also, they won't read the thing out. They're not Ron Burgundy. They're not reading the auto cue unquestioningly. You know, we've all known ministers who will do that, but, you know, your one as my one.
Like Harper, I can't remember him saying pinko, but I do remember him telling bureaucrats, I can hear the pens dropping. I'm picking the reporter. And that was his line when the reporters would just drop their pens because he still imagined they wrote with pens.
Yeah.
But he's like, I can hear the pens dropping. And you're like, okay, noted.
Did either of you ever put anything into a script so that it could be taken out? You know the old rule of an editor. So somebody feels like they've got ownership and they can go, oh, I don't like that. Take it out.
Oh, all the time.
Yeah, I think there have definitely been times. I mean, once I had to put a senior official got really, really keen on trying to, in his words, provoke her by having a bit in a speech about cashmere sweaters. It was meant to be an attempt to try and demonize the protectionists who want to keep tariffs high. And so he was like, please could you put in these four paragraphs? And then we have these protectionists who just want to keep prices high so they can, you know, dress their families in cashmere sweaters. This is protectionism, my friends, you know, and all this sort of, and this is, you know, businesses who only care about the bottom line. It was proper sort of frothing, you know, red meat sort of stuff. And I remember in the room when, you know, taking that draft forwards to her, she's reading through it. The temperature drops when it gets to that bit. And she then sort of says, hey, so can you tell me who butchered my speech? Just like, so it's like these moments you realise, I was trying to warn him. I was like, I could put the spirit of it forwards. I could put an essence. He's like, no, I just want to see what she says. And then a whole argument spins off about that. You know, it's the creative processes can be quite fabulous at times, but you can be very brave if you're trying to tell the politician. Ultimately, if you mistake in speech writing that it's not your speech, it's theirs.
Yeah.
That's the cardinal error some people can make.
Liz Truss famously was out lived by a lettuce.
I have PTSD from that.
according to one newspaper.
Yeah.
And I must admit, I was on lettuce watch. I did go to the camera and watch.
The entire nation was on
lettuce watch. On lettuce watch.
Let us pray.
How did that feel? I mean, you know, you're supposed to be, you're working with the Prime Minister. She is, it's not going well. Let's put it that way. How does that feel when you're working that closely with somebody, and what was her behaviour like? What was her mood like when things so quickly went so bad?
This is one of those things where given how like objectively awful it is to kind of be in that state of affairs, I for my part was not going to be proactively bounding up to her and saying, you know, are you tuning into the Daily Star live stream, Prime Minister? You know, that's not my place. I think I was
career limiting move,
a courageous move, as Hurst Humphrey would say. And so I think, to be honest, I was just keeping my head down, focusing on the next projects, you know, trying to keep that sense of momentum going, as even if others may have thought there was, you know, draining from the building. And, you know, knowing that, you know, after a while, politics clearly took over. But, you know, you had the first month, which was just hit the ground running, do the energy intervention, speech for the Queen's death, 10 days of national mourning, and then straight into, let's see now, you know, obviously the now notorious mini-budget, the fallout after that, and then the conference speech. And then it's sort of fast forward straight to kind of, then she's having to, well, by that point, I'd basically left the building for, you know, personal reasons. And, you know, for full disclosure, the birth of my first child, you know.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So it's a weird event where I just basically watched from a hospital ward, you know, effectively her giving the final speeches, you know, in which it was very clear, like, she'd had to work on those. Those were her own words, very much so. The emotion, the contrition.
But you were part of writing that.
Not those ones as
not
such, because I think the beginning of the process was when I'd left, effectively.
Right, okay.
Thinking I'd go on paternity leave and come back to a job, shall we say. yeah, need to say events, you know, a week is a long time, and 2 weeks even
certainly
longer.
In politics, yeah.
At that point, it's just such a maelstrom of emotions when you're watching, you know, the closing of that chapter. In some ways, grimly inevitable, because once you know after the conference, yes, the speech, the Anti-Growth Coalition one, was this kind of highlight, but of such a low series of events in which the wheels had come off, in which it emerged the party was not going to come together behind this leadership. So it was, yeah, quite the roller coaster.
What was the moment that you felt that Liz Truss knew the wheels had come off? Because often politicians seem to be oblivious to moods, or they say, look, if I can last a week, then I can outlive this.
I think there were brief moments when we knew the stakes were how dangerous and high the stakes were in the run-up to the conference speech, when, you know, conversations would come on, you know, bringing it all together, the kind of trust-like vision the Prime Minister had. And, well, let's put it this way, because every time, you know, the speech formation was actually very smooth. It was just telling her story, why she believed in growth and why it was so personal to her growing up, you know, where she did, what she wanted to do in office, what she saw as the opposition. You could start to see the emergence of battle lines for any election campaign she'd go on to fight, you know, with a bit of a peroration at the end, you know, and this, my friends, is why I must deliver and all that. Get them clapping, job done. The sensitive bit, of course, is, you know, and we must make sure that we're going to cut taxes for working people. We've done this in the mini budget. We're doing this on 45p. Obviously, I was just queuing up, really teeing that up. And occasionally we'd circle back. There'd be moments where you think, OK, do you want to use that language? You know, I would have people in the party sort of begging me to change it, to sandpaper the lines, to, you know, not be so on the nose and saying we are abolishing this and we're, this is why we're doing it. But then clearly, again, events overtake themselves. Like, that was the only bit that required an edit, in some ways, a bit of a red penning, was when she'd done the U-turn on Monday night. And I had to sort of excise that section and rewrite, and we are now listening. And, you know,
that's the other thing too. I think it's an important one that, you know, we just went through this thing about who's delivering it, what the moment is, and then there's a context around it. Like, that speech I thought worked very well in terms of what those speeches are meant to do, which is give you a sense of who this person is and what they want to do. But if the whole world's on fire around you, nobody's going to hear that.
No.
You know,
no.
And in just in the same way that, if you remember Theresa May's speech, where just the stuff falling off behind her and it was so of the moment that she
was
could
that
have been,
a
she could have been,
well?
Yes.
Yeah, it was,
she,
and all the letters were falling she, off.
P45 letter, yeah. You know, and then the coughing, remember?
She could have been Barack Obama delivering, you know, Peggy Noonan delivering, you know, and it all would have just gone to shit because, and that's the frustration in the role, is that you know that you have something important to say and you know it's not going to get a fair hearing. And yet you still have to kind of show up and turn the crank.
How do you PR that, though? Let's take that to reason. Theresa May moment, where all the letters are falling off, the endless coughing. I mean, it was.
You just have to lean into it. You can't pretend it didn't happen because everybody just saw it happen, and you have to say that. Yeah, not quite them's the breaks, Boris Johnson style, but you have to have a bit of sense of humor about these things.
Yeah.
I think that's
ultimately
sometimes the best you can do, because people do feel sorry. Like, it was getting to the point where people felt sorry for Theresa May. Because, you know, and this is like, we've all turned up for work on an important day and have had days like that. You know, we've had that cough, lost our voice, you know, blanked on air. All that, everybody's been there. And so you have to lean into that very human kind of feeling about that. And even, I bet you, the kind of peak trust or fuck, but you have to have that empathy, like, especially if you work in that business, because there, but for the grace of God, go I. And that can happen to anyone. And often it's not your it's
can
not
Can I dive
in
on
gift.
That, actually, for a second? Because
sure.
you mentioned the Theresa cough care. I think, well, I remember we with the team certainly tried to learn from that in a way, because
Get super glue.
I think the letters are now laser projected onto the walls, so that that's one of the big reforms they've done since. It's more that just to make sure, from a speaking perspective, that just as you know you're demonstrating now for those you know recording, to make sure to keep drinking at the appropriate moments, you need to make sure the throat's lubricated. That sounds really mundane and like a sort of COD doctor sort of advice, but when you are speaking for 30 minutes nonstop and you have to have the variation of emphasis and you know, here's the clap line coming up, that sort of a level, you want to make sure that it's still crisp at the end, you don't go hoarse. Whereas obviously Theresa, as we know, she was speaking at all these receptions beforehand, she'd run herself ragged, and then was having to, you know, sponsor Strepsils practically by the end of it.
Did you actually write that into the speech? We would do that occasionally in the parentheses to say, sip water, take a pause, and then the odd politician does go like, and applause.
Strong message here, Corbyn said.
Exactly.
I think she
repeat for emphasis.
Drink during the applause lines.
Yeah.
You know, so you don't just sort of do it at random moments. Do it when it's appropriate and natural.
Also, pro tip, it's always good if you're doing a Q&A with the media to have water, because it gives you a reason to pause and consider the question you've just been asked.
And
without
warm
it looking
water.
Like without yeah,
warm water
without looking like you're trying to dodge the question, you can acknowledge the question, take a sip of water, have a few beats to think about instead of having any deer in the headlights. Kind
warm
of
water is better than cold.
Well, this is the broadcast professional.
Yeah,
this is
absolutely.
This tip brought to you by.
Well, it is, because it just nicely loosens.
No, I believe you. You know,
just saying.
I'm just saying. My water here is cold, so somebody clearly didn't listen to the instruction.
It's not sabotaging.
Exactly.
How would
Damn
either
it.
Of you PR Liz Truss now?
I think in the main, she wasn't wrong about the biggest challenge facing the economy, and that it is that it doesn't grow quickly enough to fund all the things that we hold dear and want. And even if you disagree with her policy prescriptions on how to get that growth, I don't think she was wrong. And it's just in the kind of way that Trump wasn't wrong about the feeling in the United States in 2016. Yeah. We'd had 30 years of politicians promising stuff that didn't come true or wasn't working. We had the financial crisis that didn't set any bankers back, but set regular people back. There was carnage, and people were angry about that. And then Trump got the policy wrong and went and didn't fix the problems he identified. And I think Truss never got the chance to kind of take a full swing, although I think they took too big a swing, again, ignoring that context, and that you have to project your policy and your view of the world into the real world that exists now. And, you know, Rishi Sunak had spent a whole summer going, well, we can't do that because the markets will. And Liz Truss has said, well, like, basically, fuck them. I think we just have to be bold. And the markets clapped back, and there was some dodgy financial plumbing underneath that made it explode more than maybe anybody thought it would. But I think you'd have to lean into the fact that these ideas are still important, and that I still have a role as a believer and a champion and somebody who studies these issues and making sure that they don't drop off the agenda, that we don't become too cautious, that yes, it didn't work when I did it, but that doesn't mean that it's not part of the mix going forward. So I think that's what she's going to try to do and what I'd do.
Yeah, it's interesting that, because definitely I've been asked before, you know, whether does this mean that trustism's been debunked and failed? And the point I normally say is that, you know, real trustism's never actually been tried. It's instead
Didn't
what
the
she...
communists say that over
well,
and over?
Well, like, there's an echo of that in a sense. But more crucially, I lean into that sort of because, you know, by the end of it, she basically was having to sort of gut her entire program. And so I think it's that, you know, where I'd be taking it forwards. And I think she's now forging her own path independently, is to say that, you know, in your heart, you know she was onto the right idea. So she basically was just a bit too intense for everyone, you know, to keep pace with. Because obviously you had 10 days of everyone not thinking about this stuff, thinking about, you know, remembrance of, you know, our dear late sovereign and what would come with King Charles. And then suddenly it's right, hyperspeed, straight into the mini-budget. We're doing those tax cuts and now even more tax cuts, you know, and then having to get into complex arguments about, but why now? Why this? Yeah, so she was just too fast for people to catch up with. So I'm leaping into defences, but the point is, the ideas are right, the implementation wrong.
There's nothing the Hacks and Flacks team enjoy more after a lively record than relaxing with a delicious beer. And as we're a generous bunch, we want you to get in on that action. And so we're offering you the chance of grabbing a free case of craft ales from Beer 52. Yes, you can claim a free case of exceptional beers by simply going to www.beer52.com/hacks and cover the meagre. There's nothing the Hacks and Flacks team enjoy more after a lively record than relaxing with a delicious beer. And as we're a generous bunch, we want you to get in on that action. And so we're offering you the chance of grabbing a free case of craft ales from Beer 52. Yes, you can claim a free case of exceptional beers by simply going to www.beer52.com/hacks and cover the meagre postage costs of £5.95 to claim your free case now. Each month, Beer 52 send their members a case of unique and varied beers from a different part of the world, which includes their ever-insightful Ferment magazine, where you can learn about the breweries, regions and the wonderful world of beer whilst enjoying a phenomenal selection of fresh and tasty craft ales. And as fellow newshounds, I'm sure you'll love learning what's new in beer as much as we do. And there's also a couple of delicious snacks to enjoy too. Also, if dark beer is not your thing, you can choose the light-only case. And even if, after all that, you're still unsatisfied, you can simply pause or cancel any time. So why not join us for a drink and sip along while you listen to the next episode of Hacks and Flacks by going to www.beer52.com/hacks to claim your free case now. That's beer52.com/hacks. Cheers. Let's have a look at the role of political speech making in the digital age now. Have they got to be different? Do you have to just build them as a series of sound bites or of, you know, bits that can be thrown out onto social media?
I think you have to be aware that you're in the age of TikTok, there will always be that key 30-second clip that will run on social, that will run on, you know, the news bulletins. And so that's why, yeah, that's where often increasing amounts of focus will be there. But at the same time, given you have to not just appeal to the media, but also appeal to, you know, your party colleagues, you know, your rivals, they will all be looking for the rationale. There'll be the markets. There'll be counterparts in other countries trying to understand why you're about to announce the EU referendum in for your David Cameron at Bloomberg, for example. You know, you really have to set this out in that kind of logical flow. Make clear, you know, what it means, what it doesn't mean, what it means we're still part of Europe, you know, and all this. But you ultimately have to get to the point. You still have to follow that simple structure of, I'm here to say this. I've just said this. This is what I've said. And so the audience has one clear message.
Because I tell you, as a broadcaster, I will not watch the speech. I will read the speech. Okay. So I won't watch the speech, but I will watch clips of the speech, what other people deem as important. And then I will literally read the speech word for word and see what I find important. I find, for me, as a broadcaster, I get a deeper understanding of the speech seeing it on paper. Hmm. But a lot of people don't bother to read the speech as I do. They will just watch those clips, and that can really warp a message.
Yeah, no, and when you construct these things, you do have to take into account the formats. You've always had to do that. And of course, it was easier when it was just, say, a print newspaper, and you knew they could take whole huge sections of your speech lock, stock, and barrel, and or put the whole speech in there if they wanted to. And then you had radio, so that was the first kind of time you really had to think about soundbite, literally a soundbite of, if I'm going to get this speech across in one sentence, what would it be? And make sure that that comes through to the point of repeating, I've said this, I'm going to say it again.
That's almost like the first paragraph in a newspaper.
It's like the lead. It's like the nut graph, like whatever. Every format of journalism and communication has it. And then you had TV. And so not only did you have to have the soundbite, it had to be a bit shorter, you know, because a television journalist can get 7 to 10 second clip in there, or maybe a series of them. So you had to have that. Not only that, you had to think about, what am I doing when I say that key bit? And that's the part often when they'll look up from the lectern and they beam right into the camera to give that line to make sure that you know that this is the line that I want you to hear. And now you add to that social media. So not only do you have to have all those same things, but you have to think of what the opposition will cut and chop and change in that. You have to think, okay, what works in a tweet? What works in my own release where I can do that kind of crescendo at the end and put that out in one whole piece? I can cut, and so that's the power you have now. You can put out it in whatever format you want, but you do have to think about what others will pull out and what formats they're working from. And that is now infinitely, or maybe not infinitely, but multiples of what it used to be. And a speechwriter has to think about
that. How do you make sure it's the same message, though, across all those different media?
That's the art of it. And you have to be able to, and the politician has to realize they have to punch out those lines to hit those different formats. It's not just about the words being on a page. I have to give the TV clip looking the right way. I have to give, you know, you can't stumble in that key bit because you want that one to go to radio and social. You know that this is the kind of stirring moment that is going to make me internet famous for all the right reasons. And if you stumble in the middle of that, or if your throat gets dry, you've just fucked that up. And I've had situations where the prime minister knew he did that and then rewound, knowing that it would look a bit silly. But if he didn't do that and punch that line out, it was not going to get clipped. And that was the bit we wanted clipped. And it actually perversely worked because journalists went, whoa, he backed up to say that same bit again.
Yeah.
That must be the important part. So typically you do that in repetition anyway, just to make sure that the audience gets what you're trying to say. But yeah, you cannot miss those moments anymore, in my experience anyway. So you just have to, even if you look a bit daft, do it again.
Can I just add, actually?
It's very complicated, isn't it?
Yeah, because you have to bear in mind all the audiences you're speaking to. It's not just the people in the room who you have to sort of look in the eyes, make sure they're still awake and they're with you and they're understanding it because they're hearing it for the first time, let's remember. It's also then producing the key bits of the clips, repeating if necessary, so that the lines are delivered crisply so they could be savoured in the endless replays. But then at the same time knowing that the text itself has to be clean. It has to be quotable because you know that we'll have social media colleagues pumping out sort of those quotes on Twitter, looking on graphics cards that need to look nice on LinkedIn, Twitter alike. So it needs to be sort of pithy. The reason I emphasize the pithiness is because in terms of modern speech, I think there was about 2 years ago that Boris, as Prime Minister, gave a one on levelling up that was notorious as an end product for the fact that if you looked on gov.uk, the transcript of the stream of consciousness he was coming out with was so mad that it just looked like they'd given up with punctuation. It was sort of, you know, Michael Gove speaks in, you know, crisp paragraphs.
Yes.
Boris speaks in paragraph-long sentences. That's the sort of difference. And so it was just going on saying, I wish I could tell you that everything will be fine, but it's not, and this is why we're here today, and levelling up is important. It was meant to be about levelling up. It just buried the point among reams of this. And there was an announcement smuggled about two-thirds of the way down after talking about how levelling up is not a jam-spreading operation, it's not robbing Peter to pay Paul and all this, about how they're going to invest £50 million in playing fields, you know, sort of sports, so everyone has a good sports ground near them. And you're thinking, it was not clear. If you're sitting in the room, I was rereading it, you know, you would have no idea he was there to talk about playing fields. But yeah, there we are. It's sort of the theme gets lost amid the soup, as entertaining as it is.
Did he have a speechwriter, Boris Johnson?
Well, I mean, he obviously used to write them columns for the Telegraph. So yeah. he'd have writers, but then he'd normally add some Borisian, you know, extra little ticks and touches.
Yeah.
And ultimately, I mean, that's the frustration is that as satisfied as we are getting it done on the paper, you just know that it's very rare to get a politician that will just faithfully transmit that. And often they do, like Harper would always make it a bit better than it was.
I was going to say, should they?
Yeah, no. And it's, you know, our job is to do most of the legwork. You know, at Aza's point, you have a download at the start. You take the hard work of putting that into something. They feedback. You fine-tune it. It goes. But then it's up to them to make it their own. And they usually do elevate that. And
yeah, because like if you take another speech, I don't sound like I'm a sort of Boris skeptic of his rhetorically. So he gave a speech at the UN, which people will remember amid the endless sort of UN speeches that can fall into platitudes and all the rest, because he riffed about
it's actually in front of the worst backdrop in all of public life. It looks like you're in a toilet stall. It's this green marble backdrop where you look like you're taking a piss.
No, set the scene beautifully.
Yes, yeah. There we go.
Because, you know, amid the sort of urinal-based decor.
Like, Google that shit, people.
He was essentially talking about how it's not easy being green, and, you know, as Kermit the Frog once said. And then he said to the UN, by the way, I think he was a bit mean to Miss Piggy. Sort of, only he could pull that off.
Yeah.
But
did
I think, and that, the thing is, that came come across, I think it came out later, from him busking with his speechwriter. They both watched The Muppet Show back in the day. And so you kind of win the confidence going, how about this as a sort of way to get their attention? And he ran with it.
And that's one where you're going, oh, God, that's the only thing they're going to clip in front of, like, I'm in front of the world, and that's what they'll clip.
Yes.
And, like, it's a success, and you're like, I know that, you know, you can always tell when you're in the room watching the politician deliver, like, what the line will be that comes out of it. And, you know, often because you'll see journalists going, but sometimes it's just like, oh, that's good.
But then you can contrast it with...
Or that's good, and that's not what we wanted to say today.
Yeah, that's bad. With, so bad.
Because contrast it with Keir Starmer. Who recently with his speeches, he had the...
Oh, sorry, you said Keir Starmer.
Rishi Sunak had the kind of five priorities, which he will now tell everyone about until the end of time, until the election, because he wants them to only remember that. And Keir's comeback seems to be to talk about missions. And it was a whole speech just about how important missions are, because they're missions, and this is a mission-driven government. That will mean, and I can't remember them, frankly, but I think a few people can.
I think they're the same as Rishi's, but missions.
I think they were the same. Yeah.
On a mission to
reduce inflation. At one point, he practically was doing a dictionary definition of a mission is a cause which you pursue, and you're like, thanks. Well,
it's almost like he's a lawyer.
Almost.
Oh, wait.
Now, listen, obviously, the speeches that you guys wrote were utterly brilliant, but which political speech would you have rewritten?
I didn't get to write that many important ones, so I don't really, like, I always wish I never got the assignment when it was the flooring rhetoric. We had a great speechwriter, Nigel Hannaford. I'll give him a shout out, who did all the lofty rhetoric, a student of history. And so, like, you know, the speech at the memorials to the victims of communism, that was just, it was beautiful. And you're sitting there going, oh, God, I wish I could do that.
So you don't like me. I listened to a
mine was more like, this is what we're going to.
I could have done that better. Like
Boris Johnson's resignation speech. Sure, shit could have done that better. It's like, this is your last chance to leave an impression. You know, you just never get a second chance to make a first impression, but you never get a second chance to make a last impression. Boris probably doesn't think he's done.
No, he doesn't.
I think it's like, oh, shucks, them's the breaks.
But the resignation speech is the rawest and most personal speech. So in some ways, you can't really touch that, because if he wants to be slightly
It revealed
angry
his character.
And, yeah.
And as Liz Truss's did,
with the kind
as well.
Of you must be bold, and I leave more convinced than ever. I mean, I fully respect that. You know, if that's what she wants to put it, then that's fine. I think in terms of rewriting it, I'd hark back to the Boris speech on jam and sports fields, because when he was a Telegraph columnist, the reason he was then be so great is his colour and whimsy could be contained in the 800 words, 1,000 words up, you know. But then when he's just packing it too full of jokes. Yeah, I remember sometimes the columns, he would write things. At one point, there was a slightly shaggy dog story he did about watching a fox rummage through some bins, and that led him to meditate on our fear of, you know, outsiders and strangers. And so it was like a thinly veiled message about immigration for the Telegraph. But when you kind of, you bury it in everything else, you know, in speeches, I think he can run away with himself a bit. As very much entertaining as this.
Well, let's finish today by looking at the winners and losers of speeches. Now, you were asked to do some homework. Which is the best speech, do you think, a political speech that's ever been made, Andrew McDougall?
I have a soft one spot for history. And so Peggy Noonan's speech that she wrote for Reagan, D-Day, I think it was the 60th anniversary of D-Day, the boys of Pointe du Hoc. That speech is call back to the gallantry and the mission, the purpose they serve to defend democracy. And that speech, if you go Google it and read it, it's poetry. And Peggy Noonan, who still writes for the Wall Street Journal, is easily, like, I read her speeches all day. And it is lovely. And it's something I think we could actually use today, as you think kids kind of consistently polling their support for authoritarianism, and because they're tired of democracy and how it doesn't deliver. Go back and read that speech and see what people put their lives on the line for. People like my grandfather who stormed the beaches on D-Day, and the mission, and how important it is that we don't forget that. Because America in that time, in 1984, was still coming out of a very tough period of the 70s, and it was still Morning in America was the re-election speech. And that speech played beautifully on remembering why we fight for the things we believe in. And I think we're so cynical now that people would do well to reread that speech. And I reread it probably once a year.
Really?
Oh, because it's just...
And Reagan as an actor, of course, delivered it.
Yeah, but there's a very particular, to your point about Charles, a very particular way of speaking. And you could animate him and program him to do certain things. And whereas, you know, Barack Obama's more perfect union speech is something that only he, like that is him and his element, speaking again to a lofty ideal of a colorblind society, and in a way that only he could, as that candidate and that that person. Mm. And that's when it always works well, when it's the politician speaking about something that matters to them at an occasion that befits those words. And that's when you get the kind of the true lift off.
Yeah. And Asa, what's your favorite political speech?
So I'm going to readjust the premise a second, because the thing is, for me, if you start going through Reagan and Churchill and JFK, you know, it's no, they are in the pantheon. No one's ever really going to beat them. And that's arguably because they're in that kind of exceptional category of, you know, wars and sort of poverty and famine. They're talking about such immense issues that few speakers are ever going to sort of beat, you know, Steve Jobs in business when launching, you know, the iPhone. You know, these are all sort of huge and epic moments in their times. So in terms of modern politics, I'd say it was Tom Tugendhat after the announcement of the withdrawal from Afghanistan, when he gave his really emotive speech as a veteran about what it was like seeing, you know, people being buried and going into the soil and, you know, never to return, and what it was like from his time as an advisor in Helmand, you know, seeing all the sort of, you know, damage through, you know, through those days. And that, there's a really emotive line he rounds off on where he says, you know, this need not be a defeat, but it damn well feels like it. And, you know, you could,
yeah,
saw a
perfect
pin drop moment in the standing ovation, I think, afterwards in the Commons, quite rightly.
And it's one, to our point about does it matter in the digital age, that's one of the few I can remember from recent times from the House that stood out. And that used to be the forum, because that used to be the way we had our public debates. And if it didn't happen there, it didn't happen anywhere. But now we have so many other venues and channels, and we don't have that concentrated moment, but that place should still matter for those things, for that reason, because it is an important thing to do. And I wish more politicians would pay more attention to the things they say in the House.
Well, let's end on finding some of the worst speech you've ever heard, political speech. I know.
I mean, and this is interesting.
Is it the cheese speech?
Well, no.
Is it the pig speech?
I mean, just in recent times.
Boris, the same speech.
Boris Johnson's resignation speech was just garbage. It just didn't meet the moment, and so it was so clearly bitter, and it was very revealing that way. So I'm not disappointed as an observer of these things, but I thought, you know, this is one where if you're ever gonna, and, you know, Boris has met a problem. He never accepts responsibility for anything that he's done wrong. It's been the story of his life. And what a moment that would have been if he had stood up there and go, look,
I had parties.
Yeah. Or I accept that this outcome, you know, whatever words you want to put around it. Think how much better positioned he would be now. Because people do forgive if you show that you can do that. But if you don't believe it, you don't believe it. But then it's even, you know, you might look back in 20 years and go, actually, it wasn't that bad. You know, if you think back to some famous speeches like Rivers of Blood and stuff like that, people in the room loved that speech. Mm. Like, in the moment, it was not, everybody went, oh my God, what a racist. You know, it's only with retrospection that you can see that that was the first time maybe somebody said the quiet bit out loud.
Yeah.
And then you had the 70s and the rise of kind of racial strife and you know, skinheads and all that. But it was the majority sentiment at the time. So it's even hard to apply that. What's the worst? A lot of people would say that was, but if you actually read the words and remember the reception in the room, not a lot of people thought it was bad at the time.
The thing is, I'm going to sound obsessed with the Boris Jam speech, so I'm trying to think of something else now.
It's not, it is your jam.
Quite. But I think it's that, look, I come back to the basics on, you know, a good speech is meant to have, you know, am I allowed to bring up the Greeks?
Of course.
Yes.
Yeah, good. There's the three classical virtues of a good speech. It's ethos, like, do they have the caliber? Do I trust this person when they're speaking? Logos, do they make sense to me? Does that have the logic? And, you know, pathos, which is basically like feelings and emotion. Like, does it stir me? Mm. And there's this extra one called kairos, which is the urgency. Like, am I gripped by the sort of intensity of the situation? So it's often there can be the ones where just, you know, anyone who just misses a beat, drops the ball on those moments, tends to really be sort of clangers. I sort of think of like sound bites more that stick in the head. Like when Ed Miliband was saying, you know, am I tough enough? You bet I'm tough enough. You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It's like, which he was trying to do that swagger.
I think the kids call that cringe.
Yeah.
But just look, I'm sure in 5 years we'll be criticizing which like vegetable emoji the politician used in the speech. You know, that's where we're going. And that worries me. Like I'm a sucker for rhetoric. I'm a sucker for all the Greek stuff. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Give that to me, because that, to me, I still make sense of the word through writing. That's why I write. That's why I love reading that stuff, because it does stir you in a way that a soundbite or a picture even can't.
You know what's scary? Is that ChatGPT has been able to do speeches in the style
of
people.
Don't mention Satan on this podcast.
Didn't know that was in
my future overlord.
I just love the fact that, you know, the intellect quotient.
We are
just
all
been
just ChatGPT, by the way. This is not real people here.
I just thought you'd be getting the education.
I mean, honestly, Andrew and I are very impressed, aren't we?
Yeah. No, I'm. No.
What's
I'm here
Greek
to learn
for sheep's
shit,
vagina?
I'll have to come back to you on that. Right. Sure, you find
I
on the restaurant menu.
I just thought it was worth asking.
Are you thinking about Matt Hancock again?
Yeah, no, he was a running theme in the first series, so we try to keep his spirit alive.
I'm sure,
seeing as he's in the news again.
I'm sure a sheep's vagina is in the WhatsApp somewhere. But, you know, it'll be day seven of the vagina days coming up, rest assured.
The International Day of the
I'm drawing a line under this.
Yeah, as
now,
you should. Thank
as
you.
I should. That's all.
Whoever's going to censor this, well done. Good luck to you.
Thanks, Andrew. As ever, Aitha Bennett, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
On this one. We hope to see you again. And me, Petri. I might as well just say I haven't mentioned my own name. But most of all,
don't need any introduction.
Most of all, thanks to you for listening. If you want to write a speech on your podcast app about how much you enjoyed the show, it'll be very well received. It doesn't even have to be in Greek. Goodbye for now, and see you next time for more Hacks and Flacks. Hacks and Flacks is presented by me, Petri Hoskin, produced by Amanda Redman, and brought to you by Trafalgar Strategy. If you want to get in touch with your take on the current news climate, you can do that by emailing us at hackflackpod@gmail.com. And don't forget to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time on Hacks and Flacks.